Welcome to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 90, otherwise known as season 5, episode 12. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How are you doing, Jacob?
Doing good. Always happy to be here.
And also with us, as always, is your other host, John Correa. How are you doing, Correa?
Feeling good. It's early, but I'm fun fact. I don't have an energy drink today.
That's because you're going to go right back to sleep. You don't.
Well, no, I'm also trying to cut them out. And like, I'm just functioning purely off of waking up and just chugging the coldest water possible. Just jolting the system from the inside.
That'd do it.
I hate it.
I learned this morning that I've been pronouncing Korea's last name wrong for like 5 years. It's Korea.
I mean, yeah, but I go by John Korea. I mean, it's Korea, tomato, tomato.
It's too late for me to change now. So you're always going to be Korea.
Yeah, I'm Korea. I'm still me, guys. You don't have to treat me any different.
It's been a while since we talked because we recorded the Amalia Brandon episode early. So we haven't seen each other in like 3 weeks. And in the time since I've last seen you guys, I have seen my favorite movie of the year so far, The Black Phone.
Oh, I thought you were going to say When the Crawdad Sings.
I did see When the Crawdads Sing also, but it is not my favorite. The Black Phone is, though. You guys have both seen The Black Phone, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yes. It's been out for a couple of weeks, so probably a lot of the listeners have too, but I loved it. It's Scott Derrickson, so it's kind of got that sinister vibe to it.
Yeah.
Basically, it's the short story is it's about a child kidnapper played brilliantly by Ethan Hawke and wearing probably the spookiest mask, which you all have probably seen in the promo stuff for it. And one of his victims, he keeps his victims in this dungeon basement kind of a thing. And there's a disconnected phone on the wall. Well, one of his victims is down there and the phone starts ringing and he picks it up and it's previous victims kind of giving him clues on how he can get out of there.
Also, this takes place in 1970s Colorado.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a period piece kind of. So, I mean, a wall phone isn't something you go, how do you use this? I mean,
yeah,
but, it's based on a short story by Joe Hill. It's written by Scott Derrickson and his buddy, was it Robert C. Cargill or?
Yep, Cargill.
Yeah, his normal writing partner. Yeah. But it's based on a Joe Hill story. So it also kind of has some It vibes to it. You know, mm-hmm. Joe Hill being Stephen King's son. That's where, you know, in case you don't know, that's the connection there.
I would also say it's not just It vibes. It just has that. Like I made note of it when Lindsay and I left the theater that Joe Hill learned from his father that, well, he learned like, you know what? I'm just going to make one of my characters clairvoyant. Fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to explain it really. I'm just going to. Yep. They're clairvoyant. Yep. These dead kids are talking through the phone. I don't care if it's ridiculous. It's going to work. And it does. It's weird.
Cause so well,
cause King does shit like that all the time where it'll just be like, oh yeah. And they know this because it's supernatural power. Like there's no
the
like
Shining.
Yeah.
There's a dead person that tells him this.
Exactly. He's able to sell like a really out there fantastical thing. Really as just being like a, yeah. And this is a thing. You know, even like in The Shining with the whole Shining thing, you know, because at its core, it's a movie about, you know, a father going crazy because he's locked up in a place and he's trying to murder his family. And it's like, oh, yeah. And the kid is clairvoyant. It's just one of those things that like that family's really good at selling. And like that was one of my reservations with the movie was just like, how is the actual phone thing going to work? And then in the trailer, they do hint that the sister is clairvoyant. And I was like, oh, man, this might be a little silly, but it works. It works really well. Like they sell it. Like, yeah, no, this is just normal.
Huh? Yeah, no, I was fortunate enough to actually see Black Phone premiere at Beyond Fest last year. And then I got to rewatch it a few weeks back at the New Beverly. Man, it still holds up. Like, I think I may have even liked it more the second time. it's just such a tight and well-paced horror movie. And yeah, no, just the performance, particularly from Ethan Hawke, just has this oozing menace, you know, just every scene he's in, it just is just, terrifying. What is he going to do next? And yeah, I do love that mask that he wears, you know, kind of the interchangeable thing. It was made by Tom Savini from his Callsome Studios, and it's just so iconic. It is kind of funny because it could easily be a slasher mask, but it's like this mind game serial killer thing. So it just adds another layer to it.
There's function to it because, you know, he wears different pieces at different points to convey, like, because he can swap out, like, it be a blank face or one with a smile or with a frown. And then, like, he can wear, like, the bottom half independently from the top half and vice versa. And, like, I remember reading an interview with Tom Savini and him saying, like, it was the funnest challenge he's ever had. And it works so fucking well. Like, I've never really seen a movie that introduced like a new mask that I was like, I need that mask. That mask is the coolest. But like, it's terrifying, dude, especially the first time when they introduced the frowny bit part for the when he's trying to initiate the naughty boy game, was just, and he's just sitting there in the chair with the frowny face, like, you know that part of that mask serves a purpose to show, like, I'm disappointed in you for trying to escape, you know. And it's just, it's so raw. And Hawke's performance in using those pieces of the mask and just like his body movements, he never says two sentences with the same tone or cadence or anything. So you never know what his next move is, except for the kid. And I think that's why the previous victims on the phone was so important, because it's just like, yeah, from like an outside perspective, he is chaos, and like, there's no, there, you don't know his next move, but everything's just meticulously planned. So this new kid, Finney, being in that situation, just throws it all out the door and screws him over.
Yeah. Well, that's what they say when they're on the phone, you know, they're basically giving him the tools he needs to escape. He just doesn't know it until everything clicks, and it's just so and the thing is, it's not, I've heard people say that they wish it was scarier, because it's not like overt. There's a couple good jump scares because Scott Derrickson.
There's a lot of I'm cutting you off, go ahead.
There's a few good jump scares because it's Scott Derrickson that have to do with the ghost and stuff, but it's not overtly gory, and it's not like cheap about it. It's just so tense. It's like the entire time you're like chewing your fingernails down to the nub. It's just so engaging. And this is one of those movies that it was kind of a victim of the pandemic, I think, because it got shelved a couple of times. So there's been a lot of hype about it. I mean, I feel like I've been waiting 2 years for this movie, and I'm happy to say that it wasn't a disappointment. It definitely was worth the wait. I mean, I loved this movie.
Yeah. And to go back on the jump scares, that was one of the great things about seeing it in the theater. The lady who sat two seats down from me was just in the corner of my eye. Every time there was a jump scare, boy, she was in the air. It was great.
So I was going to say, yeah, there was one particular jump scare that even though I'd seen the movie before, made me jump in my seat.
And they weren't cheap. I was trying to explain it to Lindsay on the way out. Like, they all served a purpose. It was always, you know, and it never lingered on. You know how there's that trope of like, the cat, you know, where the cat jump scare, where it's just all sudden, and then like they have the shot of the cat after just being a cat, and it's just like, oh, that was just there just to spook me in the moment. No, that was never the case. It was always just like an introduction of something, and the scene just kept going. Like, it didn't stop.
And also the jump scares, the reason that I say they're not cheap is that they weren't a product of like, say, James Wan, where you're like, someone's creeping down a hallway and it's like completely silent, and all of a sudden it comes out. It's like something is happening, and all of a sudden, bam. You know, it just comes out of nowhere. And they all, like you said, they all serve the purpose of the story. They're all like, you know, there was a purpose to that jump scare. Yeah.
It was always
so well made.
It was always something like the character wakes up, and then all of a sudden there's Ethan Hawke in the corner, just like staring at him. And she's like, what the fuck do you want? He's just, I'm just watching you. And then just leaves the room. And it's just like, what the fuck? Or with the phone, and they introduce like ghosts and stuff. It was just literally just there, you know. It was really well paced too. I wasn't bored once, wasn't like tense the whole time. They did a great job of writing these kid characters, like the sister especially had like that great attitude of just being certain of herself, very like adult characteristics of just someone who is like has spunk, but like wasn't a caricature of like a kid pretending to be adult. She just was very confident, and they provided great motivation for that. And one thing that I was very happy about was the character of Finney, because sometimes with these stories, the main kid just kind of becomes like a boring, you know, Luke Skywalker type, where there's just like not much to their personality. But they did a really good job. And Lindsay made note of it that all these kids were given just enough backstory and just enough characteristics that you could relate to them and you could project your own feelings, like who doesn't relate to at least one of the kids in the movie. And it made the world very believable, especially, which is good because you're selling a movie where dead kids are giving this kid instructions on how to escape from a serial killer in a mask. Like, you got to have something that makes it feel real. And it's the characters in the movie. And Jim Davies, wow, he's always great when he's in something. And him as the father was just haunting.
Yeah, the father was the most disturbing. I mean, almost as bad as Ethan Hawke at times. Yeah,
there's definitely a parallel there.
Yeah.
And also wanted to give a mention, James Ransone as Max, the coked out amateur detective. Yeah, no, he just stole every scene.
I just love how he was essentially like the 70s true crime podcaster. Yeah. Because podcasts weren't a thing yet. So like the cops that scene where the cops just show up, he's like, oh, you're looking for the grabber. Come in. And they're like, oh, do we have a lead that isn't this child who has dreams? and he's like, so I've been mapping that out all here. And they're just like, oh God.
Yeah, because they go in with like him possibly being a suspect. And he's like, oh no, here's what I got. And he's like Charlie in that episode of It's Always Sunny with like the yarn and the cigarette. And he's like, oh, here we go.
Pepe Sylvia.
Oh, this meal for Pepe Sylvia. There's no Pepe Sylvia.
Yeah, no, and just my favorite is the scene where he's like having the I can see all the equations moment after being coked out of his mind, set to I think it was Wizard's Ball, that 70s song. Yeah, and he's just looking at the map. Yeah, no, just it's like every character just really stands out in their own way. Like it's just a very well written movie.
Yeah, which again is very hard because I mean, you know, and I'm going to keep harping on it. It's a silly thing, you know, a disconnected phone that dad are communicating through, or a clairvoyant kid who the cops are going to try to help them with the case. You know, these are silly things, but they're because of like how well written all the characters are, how all different they are. It really sells it. And man, Scott Dexter really loves home video footage, doesn't he? I mean, was there any in Doctor Strange? I don't recall, but like the whole time I was just like, oh, we're in sinister territory here with some of these shots. Yeah.
It's very sinister, not just the lo-fi, but also the way that the ghosts are treated is very sinister. But yeah, it's definitely a Derrickson movie, which is a compliment because Sinister is one of my favorite movies from back then. And Sinister is supposedly, science has proved, Sinister was the scariest movie of all time until Host.
Oh yeah,
I guess you guys hear that study. They hooked people up to like electrodes and going by like heart rate and pulse and electric impulses. They figured out that Sinister was the scariest movie of all time. But I think Host dethroned it, and I don't think the Black Throne is going to dethrone Host because it's not as scary. But it's a better movie. I mean, it's my favorite movie of the year.
Yeah,
so far.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Ghost will always be my scariest movie. That and Ernest Scared Stupid were the ones that haunted my childhood, but that's just me.
Okay, let's move on. What else have we been watching?
I've been watching some movies out of the Chattanooga Film Festival, and there's some good stuff on the way. Particularly one of my favorites, it's funny, it's actually more of a duology, is called The Third Saturday in October, Parts 1 and 5. So you guys know me. I love Dubro Party Massacre 3. And this isn't exactly like that, but it is similar in that basically these filmmakers created or reverse engineered their own slasher franchise and made fake entries in this franchise. So like the first one, it's also weird because you watch it in reverse, because like the third Saturday in October, part five was presented first, followed by the first one. And part five is set in the 90s, and it's a bit more goofy. You know, it's a bit more of, you know, like a late stage direct to video sequel type of thing in a slasher franchise. But yeah, it's so I learned this through the movie that the third Saturday in October is a time when Alabama and Tennessee have a big football match. So it's a big day in the Alabama area. And it was filmed in Alabama. And so there's this serial killer named Jackariah Jack Harding, who like wears a suit and skull mask. He was like a serial killer that was executed, but he came back to life and started killing people again. And so he's back again because it's third Saturday in October, and he's killing people at this football party. And it's funny because then you watch the first one and it's more in line with like the original Halloween or Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's more grounded, more gritty, and it deals with like Jack getting executed by electric chair, and like he's all burned and stuff, and he comes back to life and he starts knocking off people one by one while the parents of some of his victims kind of become like the Dr. Loomis that are chasing after him. So like I do appreciate that kind of homage type of filmmaking, but at the same time I feel like they really made it stand out on their own. So yeah, I'm not sure when it's going to get a release, but I would recommend it. And the other big one, which was actually the winner of Best Picture for Chattanooga Film Festival, is this one called The Leech by Eric Penikoff. And it's basically about this priest who is struggling with his faith, and he decides to take in this homeless guy that's at his church around Christmas, and he lets him live there. But turns into a whole odd couple situation, and this because this guy's got a lot of skeletons in his closet and a lot of crazy shit, and the priest is getting pushed further and further by the edge. And I should add, the priest is played by Graham Skipper, and it's just kind of this unhinged sort of struggle of I guess understanding and also faith and that type of stuff. And yeah, no, and it really kind of draws the line between like thriller and dark comedy. So again, that's another one that you guys should keep an eye out for.
Hell yeah.
The only other thing that I have seen since last time we talked is I finally caught up with Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. Have you guys seen this?
No, not yet.
Yeah, it's a great documentary.
It really is. It's basically about Mark Patton, who was, for lack of a better term, the final girl of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, which we've discussed it before at length, is considered the gay entry into this series. And it's interesting is because the actor himself, Mark Patton, is gay. What struck me about it, and it kind of pissed me off, is the writer kind of threw him under the bus and said, basically, it wasn't written to be gay. That's what Mark brought to the role. And towards the end of the documentary, they get these two guys in a room, and the writer, he backtracks basically everything he's ever said. And Mark Patton kind of lets him off the hook. But what else is he going to do? You know, yeah. He basically just wants closure. And he says, you know, all I really want is, you know, an apology. And the guy, and he gets it. But it's just such an interesting story about basically what this movie did to this guy's career.
Well, and that's the thing, because, you know, we watch a lot of documentaries that go back to movies, hint to our guests later. but the great thing about the Scream Queen doc is the fact that it's not a little bit about it is about making Freddy's Nightmare Freddy's Revenge.
Yeah, Freddy's Revenge, yeah.
Is about making Freddy's Revenge, but it's more so about the actor's journey and, like, you know, going through like, oh, I'm the lead in this, in the first sequel to this super popular movie. My career is about to take off and everyone, you know, they're pumping a lot of money into it. And like, I'm going to have all these opportunities. And then the backlash, and it was intense, the backlash to it, because suddenly, you know, and people were, because we all know how fanboys are and how toxic they are nowadays with the internet, they still were back then, and basically putting all the blame on this one actor. And then you have the writer of it coming out and saying like, oh, I didn't write it like that, that's, it's because of the actor. And it was very intense, and like just going through all that. So seeing that road of him coming to terms with, you know, the character, because, you know, I feel like it's kind of like it's Pet Sematary 2 or a few or a bunch of other sequels, or Halloween 3, where it was ravaged when it first came out. But now it's got like a really dedicated fan base, me included. I love Freddy's Revenge. I don't think it's the best made film, but it's so entertaining and it's so much fun. And seeing that sit down is just so intense, because you can see that there's so much that he wants to say to this writer and just tell him off. But he takes the high road and goes like, you know what? I'm in a good place. I thank you. You know, I got my closure that I wasn't crazy all this time, and that you and him admitting wrong and all that. And like, there's a bit of validation, and I, you know, it's just wasn't expecting to cry a little bit during that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Here I am. Oh, I'm going to watch this documentary about Freddy's Revenge.
But, a couple things that struck me about it is, first off, it was a great time capsule of that period of basically Hollywood in that period, because it goes into basically the AIDS scare and like with Rock Hudson and Dak Rambo, you know. And I didn't realize that Mark Patton was HIV positive, because his boyfriend was Timothy Patrick Murphy. Is that who he was, from Dallas? They were in a relationship and he passed away from AIDS. So I didn't realize that Mark Patton was HIV positive. And it was a whole lot of that whole like he being ostracized, and like how no one, you know, it goes into how people didn't want to do screen kisses with Rock Hudson. It's just like, the ignorance, but I understand it, because it was relatively new at that point. I mean, I think Freddy's Revenge was 1985, I think. So, you know, HIV and AIDS was brand new and people were still afraid of it. You know, these are the years that Ronald Reagan was denying that it existed, you know, I mean, which, you know, hey,
fuck Reagan,
talk about history repeating itself. But the other thing that struck me about it was how likable a guy Mark Patton is, because he once someone tracked him down, he started doing the convention circuit. I've heard this explained by other people too, but the way he explained it is like, somebody comes up to meet you who's a fan, and if you're having a bad day and you know, are rude to them, that's their one little impression of you as a person. So he's like, you can't do that. You have to put that stuff in your pocket, because to you, you know, you're meeting hundreds of these people a day at a convention, but this person is meeting you once, you know. So and I found that, like, it's like, that's pretty deep, that, you know, you have to, there's no time for a bad day, you know, when you're in that position. So
yeah, he seems like just a really nice and genuine guy. And I know you, Jay, said that you got it during a Voodoo sale, but the Blu-ray put out by Enjoy the Ride, one of Vinegar Syndrome's partners, is also just incredible for it. The slipcover is so much fun. It's packed with features. Can't help but recommend the hell out of this movie. And it's on Shudder, too, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it is cool. On Shudder. Got on my watch list. I should check it out.
Cool. Yeah, it's definitely worth watching if you're a fan of behind the scenes and, you know, documentaries. And speaking of behind the scenes documentaries, and we have a couple of very special guests this episode. They are the directors of Pennywise, the story of It, a new documentary about It, the 90s television series. Please welcome Chris Griffiths and John Campopiano. How are you guys doing?
Good, man. Thanks for having us.
The question I always like to start with for all of our guests is, what was your gateway to horror? I mean, what made you gravitate towards the horror genre?
Chris, you want to start it off?
Oh, go on then. horror. I'd say it was a healthy balance of a bad upbringing by my parents, really. I think that the cusp moment was probably my old man putting on the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre when I was about 8. And it was still banned in the UK at that point, and it was really taboo. And I'd been put to my bedroom in the past, you know, like, oh, we're watching a horror film, and I'd hear all the screams and, you know, the blood squibs going off in another room, wondering what that was. But I think it was Chainsaw Massacre was that watershed moment for me where it was like, I felt my soul drop inside me, like sheer terror, but I kind of liked it. And from then on, it's just gone from there, really. That I would say that in a nutshell. How about you, John?
Oh, for me, so I was an only child growing up. And so my diet of horror films came from the older brothers of my friends in the neighborhood, and they would rent stuff. And I think thinking about it now in hindsight, they probably got a kick out of putting stuff on and watching us kind of squirm and freak out. I think the first one for me was Silence of the Lambs that I saw that really kind of blew my mind. And kind of like Chris, gave me like a rush where I was like terrified, but kind of liked it too. So I would always sort of find myself peeking around the corner when they'd be watching something and just kind of freak out a little bit. And then it was always like all the slashers, Friday the 13th, all that stuff was a part of that early diet for me.
How did you guys get into filmmaking? What was the start there?
I guess it just stems from the love of films, to be honest. I mean, in a nutshell, I was never the most academic. I think I did pretty terrible in high school, to be honest. And then the calling came when I finally took on, I think when I took media in college, it was the first time I ever saw a bee. I've never seen a bee before. And then it just sort of, you know, it kind of unfilled in that respect, basically. And obviously, what better way to kind of justify all those years of my mum buying me VHSs, DVDs. And like, look, I've got a somewhat almost career out of this thing now. So, yeah, proving my mum wrong. That's what it was about.
It was a total accident for me. I never studied media or anything like that. And another colleague and I did a documentary about Pet Sematary a bunch of years ago. And that really was also kind of an accident where we just found ourselves going up to Maine and trying to look for locations and meet people and that were associated with the movie. And before we knew it, we sort of had what looked like a film. And ever since then, I really got bit by the bug and loved the process and loved interviewing people and finding media and stuff that nobody had seen before. And so that kind of just set me on my path to doing more projects.
And like you mentioned, you did the Pet Sematary, the Unearthed Pet Sematary.
Yeah, that's the one.
And Chris, you did the Fright Night one.
That's right. Yeah.
You're So Cool, Brewster. How did you guys team up for this one? How did you guys meet and decide to tackle it?
I always feel compelled to say this. I'm almost certain. So for starters, I'm absolute crap at, you know, oh, you sent me a message. Oh, I didn't see it. Or, you know, it always gets lost in the cluster. I'm almost certain. I'd have to backtrack a good few years now. I think John actually approached me first. And then he realized, no, I'm not getting anything out of this bugger. So John got in touch with Gary. But we all had Gary, who's the producer of these projects. Gary Smart. There we go. Happy Gary. You're on the podcast now. So in some way, shape or form. But we actually had a mutual friend, John and ourselves, which was Bart Mixon, who was the special makeup effects supervisor on countless amount of films. But specifically his pride and joy, I think, will forever be his monument is creating the original Tim Curry Pennywise. I think that kind of unfolds naturally to then John's relationship, really, as obviously a massive fan of the film.
Yeah, and I think Bart also had worked on Pet Sematary. He and his brother did a little bit of special effects stuff on that, and more so Pet Sematary too. But
yes,
so I had met him doing that project, and then I think, you know, Gary and Chris discovered kind of along the same time that I did that he had this wealth of archive material from the miniseries. And Bart's been like an amazing documenter of his own work over the years. So I think once we knew that we had all that amazing material that nobody had seen before, I think I probably convinced Gary that give this American guy that you don't know a shot to come on board and help make something happen. So.
Yeah, because there's a lot of really great behind the scenes, just, you know, of you see Tim Curry just kind of screwing around behind scenes and seeing the kids mess around. And that was like some of the fun. I liked a lot of the scenes where they were talking about like, yeah, the kids were really great, but they kept screwing around too much. So we had to take them aside and talk to them. But then the adults were worse, but no one stopped them.
Right.
And on all that, I wanted to ask, because a lot of that archive material made it into the movie, but how much overall would you say there is?
Wow. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot, but I remember Chris and I, we were like, we wanted to get as much as we could in there. I mean, I feel like the best of what's there made it into the doc. Don't you think, Chris? I mean,
yeah, 100%. It's all about how it fits in, like, contextually. And obviously, the thing is that what they did capture is, and we have utilized in some places, there's a lot of like multiple takes of singular scenes. Mm-hmm. You can actually differentiate things like Pennywise and the kids in the sewer because you've got like one take where he hasn't got the please someone help me, the thing that clowns wear around their necks, the collar in some shots. So I mean, to be honest, as John said, one of the exciting parts about making these documentaries, one of my favorite parts really, which I don't particularly have a massive hand in doing myself, but John certainly does, is the collating all the archive materials. And we do this as fans, and I think there's nothing better across all projects when you come across, because we've obsessed over these films for all these years, and so someone shows you a photo, you're like, yeah, I've seen that one of Tim Curry smoking a cigarette under the umbrella countless times. But when these other ones come up and you're just like, oh, and it'll fit in context to what someone's saying. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely mind-blowing. So it not only is it the videos, it's the photos as well. And it's incredible how many, I'll let John sort of explain that he got through the cast themselves and Bart.
Yeah, I mean, Bart kind of he's our champion time and time again, it feels like. There was like a lot of material that we found. There were some photos that like we never had context for. I don't know if you've seen, I think you've seen these, Chris, but Bart had some photos of like, Tim really had a sense of humor on set. And at one point in Vancouver, somebody had a life-size cutout of George Bush and in full Tim Curry, you know, Pennywise makeup, he was, you know, doing some sort of graphic suggestive stuff to the cardboard cutout. Couldn't really find, there was really no place to put that in context in the doc. So that left on the cutting room floor, but we used a good amount of the stuff that we found, which was hundreds and hundreds of photos. You know,
that cardboard cutout would have made a great stinger, just like at the end after credits.
Oh my god! I know. I'm pretty sure Bart explicitly said, like, maybe don't use that one. You know.
Now I want to see it.
We want to stay in the good graces of Tim and his people, so we played nice on that one.
And you don't want to piss off the Bushes.
Yeah, that's true too.
Now, you mentioned the interviews. You guys pretty much talked to everybody who's still with us, because Harry Anderson, John Ritter, Jonathan Brandis are sadly no longer with us. But the one noticeable absent cast member is Annette O'Toole. What happened there? Why couldn't you get her?
That's a great question. We tried. We tried really hard over a couple of years, and she just respectfully declined. There was no reason given. My wife and I even went to New York City to see her do an off-Broadway play and met up with her afterwards. And she was super cool and took photos and talked. But then was just like, nah, I'm not interested. So I don't know. It's a mystery, man. It feels like, and I'm sure Chris would agree, that it seems every doc we work on, there's always one or two people that you really like, we couldn't get, you know, for whatever reason. And that was obviously ours for this one. Would have been great to have her, but yeah.
It's kind of to be expected. Yeah, as John said, it's definitely to be expected. We've had it ourselves with, you know, Dead Mouse Productions, where we couldn't get someone. We thought we had Clive Barker for a moment with the Hellraiser documentary. We didn't have Clive Barker for the Hellraiser documentary. Rubber Doc, kind of the same, but we did eventually, after about 5 years, get Peter Weller with a lot of tugging. Not like that. Sure, I shouldn't use a term like tugging, Peter Weller. That sounds fun. Oh, God, no. Oh, this is why I'm a terrible guest. But it's always going to happen. And then, to be honest, it's what you'd find surprising, and hopefully it does sort of shine through with Pennywise. It is amazing getting the cast. It's amazing getting the band back together and everything. And I think, to be honest, we lucked out how great everyone was. But what you do actually find sometimes, it's the people in the smaller roles or the lesser involvement who sometimes got the better stories, you know, people who worked on the set, because for the cast, I mean, all of them, and hopefully it shows, it was a massive deal, especially the kids, to be in a project like Stephen King's It. But for some of the crew members, especially because it was all such a local affair in Vancouver, the enthusiasm, the memories and everything they collected, they capitalized on that situation to remember things. So a number of archive materials did come from like local crew members. And so actually you sometimes get the richer stories because they're paying more attention to what's happening at the time, because it's such a huge situation for them. I don't know how we got to that point, but well done, Vancouver guys.
No, it's true. I mean, most of the main talent on these films oftentimes are really isolated. You know, they're kind of like whisked from their trailers. They shoot their stuff. I mean, even Tim, you know, Tim, they'd fly him up for a long weekend. He'd shoot some scenes, go back to LA, and he wasn't really around. And oftentimes it is those people, the script supervisors or the gaffers or the second ADs or whatever, that were more in the trenches and were around a lot more. and have the memories and have the media and the archive and stuff. So yeah, Chris is totally right on that.
Having Tim Curry around limited, it probably worked better for the production anyway, because nobody got too familiar with him, you know?
Yeah.
So they were scared by him. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And we were probably the same when we met him as well, to be honest. if I recall rightly,
we all went out to breakfast beforehand, and that was a quiet breakfast. And for that to be a quiet breakfast with our crew, you know, we were kind of just like a little nervous.
That speaks volumes.
Yeah.
Tim Curry's, he's a legend. When he popped up on screen, I'm all, yes, they got Tim Curry. Because I mean, and also for my money, between Frankenfurter, Darkness from Legend, and Pennywise the Clown, those are three iconic roles, and they're roles where he's slathered in makeup. So, I mean, for him to be able to make such iconic roles where you barely see his face, I mean, that's an actor. I mean, he's a legend. I would have been nervous meeting him too.
It's always the same when we have these people. Then, as John said, to just echo that,
you like, want to throw
the
up.
Tension we all feel when it's like, okay, boys, this is the big one, and hopefully, again, showcases how much of fans we are. We're not just doing this for the hell of it, or, you know, hey, look, here's something that could maybe one day make us money. It's nothing about that. It's all about like the love of the game. And so when those moments come, it really is just like squeaky bum time, you know, and you're just all waiting there. But that, you couldn't have been more hospitable, to be honest, when we got there. I think it's one of the few interviews where we rocked up and a table was set with iced coffees, orange juices, cereal bars, and God knows what, like, you know, full on platter for us. Of which I don't think any of us touched it because we were too scared. Like, no, thank you. No, that vanilla coffee. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing that comes across in this documentary, because it as a story, and especially with the miniseries, you know, you're dealing with a lot of people confronting their fears, and a lot of these people are children. And so in the movie, you know, the kids are facing their worst nightmares and stuff, and these are all scary things. And that's a tough thing for people to handle. And I one of the things that I really respect about your documentary is these actors were very open about talking about that, the ones that played kids. But especially like when one of the actors is talking about when the bullies are bullying them, you know, with the knife and stuff, mm-hmm. and like discussing these really hard moments of, you know, real things that happen or something that they might have experienced. The actors seemed very open during these vulnerable moments. What was it like being in the room while they're opening up about these hard things to talk about?
I think it's like Brandon, isn't it? They're very candid, actually. That's the beauty. I mean, Brandon in particular, I can say this myself as a stocky lad, you know, he's very candid about, I guess you'd call it, at least we call it over here, I'm sure it's similar there, it's like the whole puppy fat thing of being a kid, you know, mm-hmm. which you're susceptible. I had it, you know, for being a large lad and everything. And he's very candid about those things. And so it's never over dramatic in terms of the interviews, but the tone can shift when you do these interviews. Like, hey, let me try and remember this. And then you get to that, you know, taboo topic. And it's just like, all right, gentlemen, assume the position.
Even like Jared, you know, like Jared talking about his father, I feel like none of us saw that coming, you know, and him kind of getting emotional. So yeah, I think it added, you know, kind of an authenticity to the doc, you know, having the kids, now adults, obviously kind of reflecting on whether it was the weight issue or having to be, you know, subjected to like racial slurs in the story, in the film. You know, I thought people, like Chris said, were really candid. And I think it was conveyed on screen pretty well, I think, in the doc.
It's like, Oscar winning moments, isn't it? That's it. Yeah. Drama.
And something I also wanted to ask about is just you know, kind of examining the cultural impact of it. I love the intro talking about, you know, just all the different people who became afraid of clowns because of the It miniseries, because it was one of those things where, you know, I was a kid and I caught it on TV and it scared the hell out of me. And it is hearing a lot of people say that over and over again, just kind of made me feel validated in that fear. And especially, you know, in the wake of the other remake or adaptation, two-part adaptation, what would you say was your reaction to just kind of the sheer response to people's reactions to the original miniseries and just kind of and looking over just kind of how wide an impact that was.
It was interesting because we shot the bulk of the documentary before the chapter one cinema version came out.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. And obviously we were chatting to the cast, like, you know, what do you think about this and how do you feel? Obviously such comments now are going to be completely dated if you watch them in the documentary, like, oh, I'm really looking forward to that film that came out a few years ago. And it was kind of just an interesting, it was almost a perfect time to be doing it because the whole buzz for It came back. And I think it's great, to be honest, what the new films have done. I'm one of those people, I think John will definitely back me up on this, where it's a bit like, you know, you do a generic Pennywise search or something on Google, you know, and when you've got the newer one kind of like saturating the images, like, no. It's the Tim Curry one. That's what we want. So it's great it brought it back into pop mainstream. But I think what's interesting is just how the years have affected people's opinions. Because there was this, to be fair, it was massive, wasn't it, when Chapter 1 came out, and even Chapter 2, which I know the general consensus was the second one being a bit of a disappointment. And I think it's a very, I mean, overall, that's the lesson learned about It, is it's a very hard book to adapt, especially that second part. I don't think anyone could ever quite nail it, can they? Because obviously, you know, it's the genius of Stephen King. But it feels, what's quite nice is everyone had this massive buzz about the new films, but I think they have started to sway back. You've seen the opinion, the shift, people going back to, do you know what? I think the miniseries got it right. Do you know what I mean? I think there are things that it got better than the cinema version. So yeah, the timing was perfect. And I think it's just, it's good to see that people have, and hopefully watching this documentary, we'll start to see like, okay, yeah, I can see why this original version is so treasured.
I was going to say, just to Jacob's point too, I think for a lot of us, you know, when things are entwined with nostalgia or like memories from when you were a kid, it sort of, well, now it transcends a little bit of, you know, the miniseries has plenty of flaws, but you don't really always think of that. You think about Tim, you think about the impact and the kids, like Chris said. I think, you know, I think one of the reasons that part two of the miniseries and part two, chapter two, didn't resonate is because you really don't, I don't really care about the adults as much. I mean, if they cast the kids well, I think like that's, for me, that's what I resonate with, you know, like the story of the kids.
John's going to look in the mirror in a bit and realize he's an adult and be like, no, I'm one of them as well. Well,
I think everybody resonates more with the kids. And I don't know if it's a matter of casting or anything. I just think the kids' story is more compelling. I mean, there's more, I mean, going back to Derry and fighting the clown when it comes back. I mean, sure, that's a satisfying conclusion, at least until the spider comes up. But but for the most part, I think the kid's story is more compelling. And with It, I think it's a generational thing because I think it was 1991. So there's a whole generation of kids that saw the 2018 movie that had probably never seen that one. You know, I mean, they've probably seen the memes and the pictures of Tim Curry, but they may not have seen the entire 4-hour, you know, miniseries. And it came along at a time when TV movies weren't allowed to be scary. I mean, back in the 70s with, you know, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, you know, they were allowed to be scary. Even Duel was a TV, you know, movie, but that kind of tapered off. And then all of a sudden you had It, and they talked a little bit about, you know, about this, you know, they, I think it was Larry Cohen, Lawrence Cohen, the writer, saying that they're pushing the, either him or Tommy Lee Wallace, one of them saying they're going to push the boundaries of what TV can do. And they pretty much did. And I think that's why it resonated with so many people that way, was because they hadn't seen it on TV before.
Right. And you could, as a kid, just be channel surfing and come upon it, right? You didn't have to like find a way to get into the theater to see the R-rated film. You could just be clicking through the channels and then stumble on, you know, Tim popping out of the sewer and like, what the hell is this? You know, and
they don't make TV movies like that anymore.
No. And, but yeah, that's what happened to me. I was flipping on the Sci-Fi channel and I saw, Seth Green getting menaced by a werewolf in a basement and I was hooked.
Oh, and just that score when you're flipping through and you just hear like the ting, ting, like of the play piano. Oh, it sucks you in.
It really does. Just like Georgie got sucked in. Careful, man. Just don't go to the blues. Don't go to the blues.
And what do you guys think is so difficult about adapting the adult part of it? I mean, it seems like it's really hard to crack. And they talk about it a lot in the documentary, Tommy Lee Wallace especially, about how hard it was to get night two, as he referred to it, just right. What do you guys think?
That's one thing that about the documentary that was so cool is like everyone was real honest. They're like, we didn't quite land the adult story. And that's something everybody has known since it aired. But hearing the people involved say it, you know, it was like, wow. Okay. So they knew it, you know?
Yeah.
Constantly. Yeah.
I think Chris, I really wanted to, I'm sorry, Chris.
No, go for it, man.
I think we had talked pretty explicitly about wanting to like be fair, you know, and like, even though we're fans of a lot of the films that we make documentaries about, to try to be as objective as possible, to really be like true. I know for me, one of my biggest regrets on the Pet Sematary documentary is that we kind of shied away from doing that a little bit. And I don't really know why. Maybe we were afraid of pissing people off, or we didn't want Paramount to think that we were slandering the film, but I feel like we wanted to make sure that, you know, we were aware of the warts, not a pun towards Richard Thomas, but we were aware of the warts of the miniseries, the spider, some of the acting, some of the writing. Part two has a lot of weakness to it. And we wanted to like be, I think, candid with that and be honest about that. And you know, so anyway.
Yeah, it's exactly what echoing what John says, you know, it's interesting. So, you know, I think one thing that I've certainly been into, why I do what I do, and probably same John has said, like, you know, when DVD first came around and you're like, deleted scenes, making ofs and this and that, there was like a formula of documentaries when they first came around. They're all like kind of puff pieces. They're beautiful. They're rose tinted memories and all this and that. But I think it's better to be honest about these things, you know, address the elephant in the room, but do it in a diplomatic way. Because you don't want people going like, well, they think it was good, but actually, you know, it's better to just be legit. And if anything, you know, you might uncover things about what could have been. And I know we kind of lightly touch upon that in terms of like, you know, the approach to the narrative of part two. I think Tommy Lee Wallace says about, you know, an initial version being a bit of a prosaic approach, or that they were going to have Bev's abusive partner be, you know, puppeteered by Pennywise. They could just never were able to quite solve that problem. And I think as everyone said, the story of the kids resonates more with the audience than the adults. So that in itself is a problem. Then you go into territory where it's about like supersonic space turtles and God knows what and this and that. No matter how much you've got in the way of a budget for effects, I don't think you could ever achieve that.
But you know, I think they even said if they had known Tim Curry was going to be so great in the role, they would have brought him back for the climate. But it's like all of a sudden, you know, they go into the spider thing and Tim Curry's gone.
Yeah.
You're like, well, no, people want to see that. And so I think if they had known he was going to be so iconic in it, they probably would have rewritten the ending.
100%. Yeah. 100%. I think, and that's the other thing, you know, I remember, I think we had a discussion in the run-up, didn't we, you know, and Bart was great about it. Let's just be honest about the spider. And I think, again, hopefully it shows. It's getting a good slate in. It got a good slate in terms of its, you know, reception in its day. But actually, you know, in a way, going back to that point I said before about uncovering things, had it been executed differently, it was all circumstance why that didn't pay off. I mean, it is a very ropey ending. It does just take you right out of it at times. But what could have been? I mean, if you look at the behind-the-scenes footage we've got, and the articulation of the animatronics of that thing is incredible. You watch the final film, and it's just these prancers. I realize we're doing an audio interview here, so you can't see me doing it. But it's, you know, whatever you call them, you know, the monocles and everything, you know, all moving about. So that's the best way about being honest on these things.
It's a pretty cool effect. The spider, I mean, the animatronics and the puppetry of the spider is cool, just not for the climax of it. I mean, the payoff of this two night miniseries shouldn't have been a spider.
I mean, I feel like chapter two tried to resolve that. Like, I think Muschietti's chapter two, where you know, in that climax where the kids are fighting Pennywise and he's constantly kind of like evolving like spider, and then it's the spider with the Pennywise head on. I feel like they tried to remedy that a little bit in the new version.
Yeah.
The best of both worlds.
And they also had like, you know, them on like a mission collecting the talismans and stuff. And you know, it's a hard one to crack because it's also just such like a big dense, and yes, the space turtle, you know, that's just not only VFX very difficult, but it's also, you know, hard to explain in such a short amount of time. Like, it almost has to be a three
like a left in from Stephen King, isn't it? I think that's kind of one of the things with Stephen King. I think it works better on the page than it does on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He always has like a few things that where it's just like, yeah, this isn't going to work outside of this. But yeah, one of the things that I really enjoy is the fact that you guys do come so objectively, because like you were saying, DVD features are such fluff pieces, and it's always weird watching a not so great movie. And then everyone's just like, oh yeah, it's so great. It's so great. It's so great. You just kind of see dead in the eyes, you know.
Studio exec guns just like so creeping into the shot like that. Like, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's fine. Wow. Okay.
Oh yeah. I love Morbius. It's so much fun. It's great being on a set.
I feel attacked at that Morbius comment.
I'm not saying you should. Yeah, I haven't seen it either, so I shouldn't make comments.
I like it as a vampire movie. I didn't like it as a superhero movie.
Well,
and that's, I haven't seen it yet.
Uh-oh. We've opened a can of worms here, haven't we?
But that's
what is we're wrapping up on time here, but what is next for you guys? What do you guys got coming up? Now, John, there's something in your IMDb that really intrigues me. This Uh-oh. Snapper documentary.
Oh, yeah.
What is going on with that? Something about a man-eating turtle?
Yeah, that's a short film, kind of another accident piece, but it was a short doc that I did last year, and it played a bunch of festivals, and I think was pretty well received. It's basically it's a story about a regional filmmaking team out here in New England that tried to make their own kind of Jaws version with a snapping turtle, and went so far as to build animatronic turtles and got really creative with how they film certain things. The idea was to make a trailer to then pitch and hopefully sell the idea to then make the feature. But again, they had all this amazing footage. They shot on 16mm and they had behind the scenes footage that someone was filming with a VHS camcorder and a lot of great photography. And so I thought it would be kind of cool, especially from the world that Chris and I come from, which is like telling stories about the making of like iconic films. So wouldn't it be kind of interesting to tell the story about a film that never really existed and fell flat. And so it was a cool way to look at sort of what was happening in this part of the country in the late 80s with, you know, DIY horror filmmakers. So that we did the festival run, and it's actually gonna be coming out on Blu-ray, coming up as a special feature on a disc. And we did a VHS run, two VHS runs of that. Just sold the streaming rights, North American streaming rights to it, Cinedigm, which is, you know, we're working with on Pennywise. They picked up Pennywise. So
now let me say, as a New Englander, I'm very fascinated by this story, and I wish that we had an iconic killer snapping turtle.
We came close. It's not too late.
What could have been?
We love Jaws ripoffs. So, you know, whether it's a bear and grizzly, a killer whale and orca, or a snapping turtle, we would have eaten that right up.
Especially in New England, another New England one, you know. That,
Or tentacles. What is that? We love our Jaws rips. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened with this podcast. We're all in California, but two of us are New Englanders.
Oh, right on.
Go figure. Transplants.
Yeah.
Okay. I kind of derailed it with the question about Snapper. What's next for you guys?
So, well, we're all working at the moment, and actually yesterday for me on a feature length documentary on Robert Englund formerly called Icon, now called Hollywood Dreams and Nightmares. Got a much classier name, I think. I'm very happy to remember that. And that is quite far down the line now. So I actually had Gary and Adam from Deadmau5 over here just yesterday. And I think we spent somewhere in the region of about 14 hours just going through about a 20-minute section on the Nightmare on Elm Street films. So it's kind of like going through its final run now. One edit's been put down about just over 2 hours. And then we're just going through the whole, a bit like the same process we're doing with Pennywise, really. That's the one thing I suppose is good to clear up as well when we do these interviews, is it does take us a while to do these jobs, but it's about doing it right is the main thing. We all hold full-time day jobs, so that's always quite a fun juggling act to undertake. But it's the Pennywise, we must have gone through a good few variations of that edit over the course of its post-production. So that's what we're doing right now with Icon. It's a little bit quicker, and thank God it's not green screen, which is always a nightmare. It's a great effect in the end, don't get me wrong, but when it gets to that moment of, you know, I'm doing the motion graphics or the editing, this, that, I absolutely hate it. So luckily we've actually shot these interviews for Hollywood Dreams and Nightmares in natural situations, you know, pretty backgrounds. So yeah, we've got that on at the moment, and RoboDoc, which has taken its time, a 4-hour documentary on the original RoboCop film. So if you like long documentaries, look out for that one when it rears its ugly head, because that's been a painful process getting that one together. But we're nearing the end on all of these. So we're just taking it to, you know, I think opportunities are starting to come up for a lot of us now, because we've gone from being like, hey, let's sell DVDs out the back of someone's garage to like, oh, actually, let's do this properly. So it, we're just going through that transition of dealing with legit official ways of getting these films out. And we're really happy to be doing that as well. You know, I think we've got what it takes, being really modest amongst all of us, to deliver, you know, because we love doing it. So yeah, whatever comes our way, we'll keep cracking on.
Oh yeah. And I'll definitely keep buying them. I have so many documentaries that are just about the making of like one movie. And it's like, why this documentary is longer than the movie was. And it's like, yeah, I love it. Like when they first announced the Blu-rays for Prometheus and they're like, oh yeah, there's a 3-hour making of documentary. I'm like, that's
wow.
It's almost better than the movie.
They are really fun to watch. I think,
we're
fans of the films, but we're also fans of making ofs. And I think it's always the fun thing about how do you keep evolving them, you know, and get the best out of them. I think what's nice is that we ultimately, what we strive to make with these documentaries is almost the final word on these films. Do you know what I mean? There's been the 10th anniversary retrospective, the 15th, right. the DVD, the 4K, the Blu-ray, and everything like that. And I think what we try and do is go, right, let's get to that end. Let's be the one. So let's get everything. Some documentaries have a bit of this or might have that person. How do we get everything all into one space? So that's the challenge. It's hard. It's really bloody hard at times. But it's just great to be like, okay, that is the definitive archival piece on the making of this film, that film, or that person.
There's always an Annette O'Toole. Yeah, you can't get.
Director's cut.
Okay. All right. Chris and John, thanks for joining us this morning. Pennywise, when does it come out on VOD? Is the 26th, July 26th?
That's the one. Yeah.
July 26th. Great. So keep an eye out for Pennywise, the story of It. Where can everybody find you guys on the internet or on the socials to find out what you guys, to keep up with what you guys are doing next?
So many of those. I mean, MySpace. Carrier Pigeon. No, I think I suppose in terms of the projects themselves, we usually have a social media channel per project. We've not really been up to date on the whole Dead Mouse Facebook page for quite some time. So that might need a bit of a cleanup. So usually I would say it's the projects themselves. I think it's, Instagram is at Pennywise Doc.
Yeah, Pennywise Doc on Instagram. Yeah, and Twitter. Yeah.
And Twitter as well. And there's a Facebook page, I think, as well. So yeah, we're search
the we're easy to find. To find us. Okay. Yeah.
at Pennywise Doc, they'll find you somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for joining us. Our theme music is by Restless Spirit, so go give them a listen. Our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so go give them a look. Go give him a look. And us, you can find pretty much on any of the socials as well. Eye on Horror. We've got them all, and they're all lovingly cared for by Korea.
And Lindsay. Don't forget our producer.
And Lindsay. Yes, our producer Lindsay. So if you have any questions for us, hit us up and we will see you in a couple of weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
I'm Jonathan Korea.
I'm John Campo Piano.
And I'm Christopher Griffiths.
Keep your eye on horror.